AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, there's been a number of social media news stories that have been through the news cycle over the past few weeks or so, so figure we need to discuss these. So bringing back to the show someone we had on a few months ago, that's Adam Razzieri. He is the Chief Marketing Officer at Agency Partner Interactive, as we're going to be talking through three topics. One is going to be this lawsuit that was filed by the Justice Department against Facebook regarding some antitrust concerns. Actually, that was the FTC who filed that lawsuit, just quick correction. We'll also be talking about Section 230, what that is, and why Donald Trump wants to see that repealed, and some other social media platforms we're seeing come up as alternatives to Facebook, YouTube, and Google that are leaning a little bit more towards the conservative side of the political spectrum. So, Adam, good to have you back on the show to unpack all of these topics.
Brett, pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely. So I want to start off talking about these new platforms that we've seen that have popped up as alternatives to some of the major platforms you're used to, like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Google. These would include MeWe, which is kind of the conservative version of Facebook, also Parler, which is a big one people have, I think, heard of a lot of over the past few weeks with the election. That's an alternative to Twitter, and there's some others as well. So I got to ask you this, Adam, because at least immediately after the election ended, Parler got a lot of traffic to their site and had a lot of downloads of their app. But now that the election is further behind us, how are these alternative platforms doing now?
Yeah, you know, I think these alternative platforms, some are doing better than others. And, you know, to your point, they're, you know, for every yin, there's a yang. For Facebook, there's a MeWe. For Twitter, there's a Parler. For YouTube, there's a Rumble. And then even still, there's for Google, there's a DuckDuckGo, which has been around for a while. But these platforms saw a huge bump just really in that week after the election. Speaking to Parler specifically, you know, this app went from almost 3 million users in July. And by the end of November, these guys were racking up. And it was about 10 million users overall. So they've experienced tremendous growth. But, you know, when you grow that quickly, a lot of issues are kind of presented to you, and a lot of startup businesses call those growing pains. So, you know, these guys are dealing with issues of scalability. They're dealing with issues of customer service. They're dealing with marketing concerns specific to how do we re-engage these users that are now on our platforms? Because it's not just enough to get somebody to download the app or to download a platform of a social nature just like these, but you also have to engage those users and give them an incentive to come back and actually be active in the community. So, you know, if I'm talking about Parler specifically, this is an app that, you know, it's been around since 2018. It's kind of been trucking along and growing slowly. But yeah, it was this election that really sparked just a ton of growth for them. And MeWe alike, which is kind of like the Facebook rival there, or the Facebook, we'll just say competitor, right? So these platforms have definitely grown. And I think what they're trying to probably do for the most part is attract funding, right? So that they can finance their business needs. Parler, I know it seems to be attracting investment from the Mercer family, and this is a family that's been known to donate to conservative causes and business organizations. MeWe as a platform, again the competitor to Facebook. This is kind of like a Facebook that really have no ads, it has no targeting. They pitch no manipulation of the newsfeed. It's a little bit clunky as a platform. Just when you get on there, it's kind of clunky, but Facebook's kind of clunky too. These guys have about $18 million in funding. I think the thing that will separate them moving forward is going to be who they hire to their board of advisors, and ultimately what sort of brain power is brought into these businesses to do something that's very important, which is to diversify the conversations and to diversify the schools of thought within these organizations, so that, you know, platforms like Parler aren't just echo chambers, right? You need a healthy conversation, not a one-sided conversation. And so there have been active efforts from a lot of these platforms to actually move toward that direction, but it definitely did not happen overnight.
So expanding on that, how are some of these platforms marketing themselves? Because you, I think, hit the nail on the head right there. Just marketing yourself as being a free speech alternative, supposedly free speech alternative to the more mainstream YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and so on and so on, is only going to take you so far when you're already facing an uphill climb against these gigantic tech companies that largely have a monopoly on the market. Talk about the marketing aspect a little bit, because that's an uphill climb, and I think you got to do something more than just saying you're the conservative alternative to Facebook, Twitter,
Right.
and so on.
Right. I think in cases where if you're the brand and you are saying we are the conservative alternative to XYZ, right? We are the conservative alternative to Twitter. We are the conservative alternative to Facebook, YouTube, Google. If you as the brand say that, you're going to shoot yourself in the foot. And it's also counterproductive to what their business goal should be, which is to attract more of a diverse usership. So what they have to do is they have to really make a strong marketing effort to appeal towards both left-leaning thinkers and right-leaning thinkers. They seem to be doing okay with the right, but they need to basically do what they can to attract more left-leaning thinkers. And with Parler specifically, what they've done is they've actually offered basically, I think they're actually calling them bounties. They are willing to pay up to 20 grand to left-leaning political influencers that will bring their following to the Parler platform to just engage in healthy conversations with the people that are already on Parler. So, you know, marketing, whether it's through influencer marketing or through brand messaging or to or also through creating partnerships with other platforms, these are different ways to do that. Rumble is basically the competitor to YouTube right now. It's got about 80 million users, and there was a huge bump in users right after the election. They actually had about 40 million users in the middle of the summertime, bumped up to 60 million users in October, and found themselves with about 80 million users by the end of November. This competes with YouTube. YouTube has 2 billion users on the platform right now, but what Rumble's been doing is they've been pitching themselves as the basically a town square, if you will, sort of just this open forum where they're not going to moderate or censor what another platform might call as misinformation. They're just going to let you speak. And if you're going to be up there and you're going to be saying something that's stupid and making yourself look stupid, that's on you. It's not on them. So they're really allowing their users to share content, whatever that content may be. But they're actually creating partnerships with these other platforms. Rumble gets a lot of referral clicks from Parler specifically. So they're finding ways to create like these brand partnerships that could potentially allow them to share users from one platform to the next.
And one of the big selling points that Rumble, Parler, and MeWe use is something you just talked about, how they have little to no moderation. But there also can be a downside to not having any moderation if you really think about it. And I'm looking at a piece that the Washington Post wrote a few days ago where they're talking about how I think Parler's basically been flooded with porn and other sorts of spam types of posts. And those types of things can also happen when you basically have no moderation, correct?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, there's obviously going to be people that are out there on the web. The web's a big place, and there are going to be people that share content that's valuable and content that's just absolute junk. You know, when it comes to kind of exposing yourself to certain types of content, MeWe, you know, again, that Facebook rival, MeWe does not present users with content. MeWe allows users to pursue types of content through search terms, through groups. And MeWe actually, it's been around since 2012, and it was founded by, their startup team is actually fairly impressive. One of their investors is Linda Weinman, who was the founder of Lynda.com. They have another investor, Rachel Roy. She's a fashion designer who has had clientele, including Michelle Obama, Kim Kardashian, who I call Kimye, Tyra Banks, and Penelope Cruz. You know, actually, this is kind of one that surprised me, but they have Jack Canfield. He's a guy over here in North Texas where I am, and he's the author of Chicken Soup for the Soul. So MeWe has an interesting business team that it's been creating pages that allow for a diversity of thought. So whether I have an interest in, you know, the Green Party or in dogs or in, you know, the Stop the Steal campaign, you know, wherever I might fall, MeWe has pages that users can basically seek out, but the content does not go to the users. So with Parler, it's a little bit different. You're going to see content that comes from those within your network. If you are not someone who is of age by any means, I believe there are some filters that you can select that will block certain types of content from you. But, I think you make a great point, though. Where is that line? Where is that divide? Where does censorship become censorship? And where does, where does that level of responsibility fall when it comes to ensuring that whether that user is not of age or, that user is someone that, it just absolutely cannot be exposed to certain types of thought. Where does that responsibility fall? And really, I think that question too has sparked these bigger discussions of Section 230. Should social platforms just be sort of like a, really just as free as a public sidewalk? Should it be a true town square where, the identities are verified, who the people are that are speaking, so that way they can be held accountable to whatever their message might be. But whatever that message is, they're allowed to actually express it. Parler does verify identities to make sure that the users on the platform are truly real people. And there's actually been some controversy about that as well. They do, I believe, require a image submission of a driver's license to make sure that you are who you say you are. But at the end of the day, if you're that user who is channeling junk through the platform, like pornography, for example, or if you happen to be tied to a terrorist organization, there are policies that exist at Parler specifically that allow them to, we'll just use the word deplatform that type of user.
You mentioned Section 230, and I want to get to that in just a couple of seconds. But first, I do got to ask, expanding on that privacy aspect, how do their privacy policies compare to the more mainstream platforms of Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube? Are they any better, any worse, or is it tough to make that comparison?
Brett, it's a really interesting question. And I think the biggest differentiator that I've kind of picked up on is the privacy policies that you have at Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Google. Those privacy policies all very clearly allow these companies to share your information with marketers like me, right? I'm a digital marketer. I can use the information that I get from Facebook to basically identify who I'm going to advertise to and who I'm not going to advertise to. So the information that they collect on you, it's your device data, the information that your mobile devices collect, where you're going, where you've been, how often you go there, times of day, stuff that's actually on your device from an apps perspective. Occasionally your browser history as well. It collects a lot of information, platforms, and this is basically used to the benefit of marketers, right? These more, we'll just say these more conservative platforms, MeWe, Parler, Rumble, and DuckDuckGo as a browser, they are different. MeWe, actually, they make their money not off of advertising, but they have a freemium model. So their users pay on a monthly basis. Kind of like, you have Wikipedia, right? And it's like Wikipedia is free, and they offer knowledge to the world. But they ask for a little bit of a donation every year to keep going and to stay free. MeWe is very open about what they need, and they're going to charge each user for premium levels of content, for premium exposure to other brands and influencers that are in their space. I think Parler is still trying to figure out what their monetization model is really going to be. I don't think they're quite sure yet what that is. And then Rumble, of course, they allow users to basically monetize their content. So the content creators are monetizing their content based on views and consumption. It's a little bit different than YouTube because they're not making their money off of the actual viewers on the platform. The Rumble content is syndicated throughout other platforms. So I think the privacy policies really, it's kind of the biggest differentiator is the business model. Am I using that advertising or am I using that data to help marketers do their thing? Or am I truly protecting the user who's on the platform and truly making an effort to not use their data for certain types of decision-making as it applies to either advertising or exposure to certain conversations that are taking place.
We're speaking with Adam Raziere. He is the Chief Marketing Officer at Agency Partner Interactive. By the way, their website is agencypartner.com. I want to move on now, Adam, to talking about Section 230. This was something passed back in 1996 that basically protects big companies from being sued for content users post on their websites. But this has been something that's been controversial during the Trump administration, as the administration would like to see Section 230 repealed. So, Adam, can you kind of give me a layman's definition of what exactly Section 230 it does? As I brought up just a few seconds ago, it at least the basics I understand is that it basically prevents these big temp companies from being sued. But go into more detail about what 230 exactly does.
Great. Yeah. So Section 230 is kind of like this, it's like a cloak of immunity. So it allows the social platforms to have, you know, it'll have your drunk uncle on the platform, and whatever your drunk uncle says, however hateful it might be or however stupid it might be, it protects the platforms from whatever content your drunk uncle might post, right? Whether it's Twitter or Facebook or whichever social platform it may be. It basically gives them this kind of like this separation from liability. And so the controversy with Section 230 is when these platforms start to become not just platforms that allow for conversations to take place, but when they're actually becoming active participants in conversations, deciding what conversations to allow and which conversations to sort of maybe put a little bit press the mute button just a little bit, kind of lower the volume on, that's where they start to kind of, I guess, teeter along this fine line where you have certain influencers both on the left and the right saying, you know what, if you guys are making decisions that basically dictate what content is on your platform, then you're basically the drunk uncle, whether you're posting good stuff or bad stuff. And so there's a lot of movement right now to try and say, listen, Section 230 is kind of being abused right now. The social platforms that retain a majority of the users in the world, you know, Facebook has 2 billion people on it, right? Twitter has 330 million on it. These are huge platforms with just a huge, huge user base. And when they have just a small group of people that work for these companies that are making these decisions about, you know, what to dial up and what to dial down from a conversation perspective, you get all sorts of people that are, you know, kind of throwing a fit about those particular kinds of decisions. So Section 230, you know, it's an older part of the Communications Decency Act, and really it's the reason why social platforms have been allowed to grow in such a way that has kind of been free of any sort of legal liabilities that might come from whatever their users might actually post.
And this is a big provision that has really benefited big tech companies over the past several years and decades because, well, if you think about other media outlets, whether it's newspapers or radio stations like us or TV stations, they play by a different set of rules and they don't have these same sorts of benefits that tech companies get from Section 230, correct?
It's fairly different. You know, and I don't know specifically what rules that some of the news organizations play under, but, you know, I do know that if they are responsible for posting something or publishing something that is just factually wrong or, you know, potentially damaging to certain people, they will be held accountable for whatever that content might be. These tech companies, though, they can decide what to dial up and what to dial down, irrespective of who the author is. It's actually interesting to see that, you know, they won't, in some cases, censor. Well, really, Twitter, for example, won't censor the Supreme Leader of Iran, but they will censor both left and right thinkers that are in the United States specifically. So, who's making these decisions about which conversations to promote? What's kind of taking place when this decision making is done? And what can we do to ensure that, if these companies are going to enjoy Section 230 immunities, that they are truly allowing for the public to enjoy this truly public forum? Right now, we're just not seeing that.
So what sorts of changes to these types of laws are we seeing possibly go through Washington right now? I know Section 230 has been a big debate between the Trump administration and members of Congress. What sorts of changes are being proposed right now, and do any have any bipartisan support of possibly even getting through?
Yeah, well, there's definitely bipartisan support for Section 230 reform. As we know, there's definitely bipartisan support for antitrust. I mean, of course, and I really kind of think that this conversation of of antitrust versus Section 230 reform, it's kind of like pick your threat. And depending on the day, our legislators will threaten one or the other against big tech. Am I going to threaten big tech with antitrust today, or am I going to threaten big tech with Section 230 today? Specific to your question about what to change in Section 230, the one thing that I've kind of seen has been a review of the Good Samaritan protections that basically give these platforms the specific immunities that they enjoy. The thing that isn't stated very clearly in Section 230 is the criteria for which content moderation decisions are made. So what are the things that are asked? What are the things that are considered? What are those trigger points that say, okay, now is the time to block this versus, you know what, we'll let this one pass. We're going to let this hit the community and see what the community does with it. There's no consistency on when these moderation decisions are made. So Section 230 would have to just be a lot more explicit and a lot more defined. Right now, it's very, very broad. So until it's more defined, until it's more specific about, you know, what those trigger points are, when those decisions are made as to keep it or scrap it, it's just not there right now.
Speaking with Adam Raziere, he is the Chief Marketing Officer at Agency Partner Interactive. That website is agencypartner.com. So I want to talk about this lawsuit that was recently filed against Facebook as federal regulators, I believe it was last week, sued to force a breakup of Facebook as 48 states in the District of Columbia have accused the company in a separate lawsuit of abusing its marketing power in social networking to crush smaller competitors. FTC said Facebook has engaged in a systematic strategy to eliminate its competition, including purchasing smaller startups and coming up rivals like Instagram back in 2012 and WhatsApp back in 2014. So, Adam, as we break down this lawsuit a little bit, at least on the surface, to me at least, it seems pretty obvious that Facebook is a monopoly. But at least from a legal perspective, what are the litigants in this case doing to argue that Facebook is a monopoly and should be broken up?
So really what they're kind of pointing to, I think, are the business practices. You know, Facebook has been so aggressive, and really when they sense something coming their way, and that thing coming their way could be the next great idea. It could be something that they see as a threat to their existing business model, or just something that they want, right? When they decided they wanted Instagram, that was a grab on really the younger millennials and kind of a move towards Gen Z, especially with the adoption of Instagram Reels. Facebook will find ways to use their power to buy either competing businesses or complementary businesses for cheap. They'll do so in a way that gives them extremely favorable deal terms and really leaves these innovative business founders, these startup leaders, with not a whole lot to show for the value they've brought to the world. Now, it's interesting to kind of read some of the emails that Zuckerberg has sent with his leadership team. And in a lot of ways, they kind of look at it as like a real estate land grab, you know, like, hey, let's go acquire this one today and let's acquire that one tomorrow. And you know what? If these guys don't want to play ball with us and they don't want to give, if they don't want to sign the NDA or move forward with this deal, we're just going to drive them out of business. That's really what they've done with both other social platforms, but also with augmented reality concepts. And so when we look at Facebook for what it is today, it's a platform with 2 billion users. I mean, just think about that, 2 billion users. That is just huge. The way the platform is used, not just domestically, but internationally, the platform has been used in a way that literally influences the behavior and the decision-making of entire nations. They collect so much information, and when that information is used in specific ways, very dangerous things can happen. You know, in Myanmar, we saw a genocide basically spearheaded by the government, utilizing Facebook as their communication platform to do so. So when these companies become so powerful, you know, you have to worry about who's going to ultimately find a way to either dictate power of what that company does or use this power in a way that's just a little bit evil. And so far in the United States, we see Facebook kind of getting more and more powerful. And yeah, there are other you know, platforms out there, but it's really hard to compete against the big dog in the neighborhood, right? I mean, they push people around with ease. So they've got WhatsApp, they've got Instagram, they have Instagram Reels to compete with TikTok. And frankly, there is kind of another discussion of, you know, good versus evil when you look at the Facebook versus TikTok dynamic, which is interesting because when you talk about destabilizing these big tech platforms, there is an international component to it. TikTok is obviously owned by China. Facebook is an asset of the United States. While Facebook might be making it hard for innovative concepts to rise up in the U.S., that next great idea, at the same time, they do help us compete against China, right? So there are so many different things to consider when it comes to the question of, you know, do we break up Facebook or do we just kind of change how they operate as a business and try to do something that doesn't harm the U.S. consumer, but at the same time allows for that next great idea to rise up.
And talking about the defenses that Facebook has been making in this lawsuit, at least, I'm sure part of what they're saying is, well, maybe exactly what you just said, talking about how, well, they're kind of a competitor to what the Chinese are doing right now, and therefore you need them to keep the United States competitive. But talk a little bit about what their defense is and their arguments, how they're not a monopoly.
Sure. So a lot of the times what you'll see from Facebook, and they really are very good at packaging up a message and packaging up whatever their case might be, just because they have great attorneys and a lot of financial resources. But for the most part, they're saying, you know what? Instagram today would not be what Instagram today is had we not come in 2012 and bought this business for $1 billion. You know, WhatsApp was purchased in 2014 for $19 billion. You know, it's a lot of money, but Facebook's trying to argue that these companies today would not be as powerful as they are had Facebook not bought them and then obviously shared their resources with those businesses. So I think that's probably one of their arguments. But then again, also, you know, Facebook and Instagram combined, they are just a couple of social platforms out of many. But then again, you'll see, you know what, Facebook, you've got 2 billion users. Twitter, you've got 330 million users. There are many others out there. I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a conversation of coverage. You know, which generation does Facebook's usership span? And when my grandpa was around, he was in his early 80s when he passed away. He was on Facebook. I'm one of the older millennials. I'm on Facebook. But, you know, a lot of the younger millennials and Gen Z, they're on Instagram and Instagram Reels. And, of course, TikTok also. But Facebook literally has coverage of every strong living generation that exists in the U.S. And you could argue the world, too. So that might be one angle for arguing towards a monopoly. But, you know, I still think that at the end of the day, the bigger arguments are going to be supporting Section 230 reform and then also general reform of antitrust laws, because those things are over 100 years old. And apart from that, also business practices, making sure that Facebook's business practices are not counter to the competitive spirit of our country.
So let's say Facebook actually does get broken up from this lawsuit, just in a hypothetical scenario. What would happen then if the company were broken up into several different companies?
Great question. So I think what we'll see is just kind of a disassembly of Mr. Potato Head. I mean, what I mean by that is, you know, you'll probably have some sort of advertising company or platform that breaks apart from Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, but it's sort of like this weird kind of like data sharing conglomerate that has ties in each of those business units, but operates very differently from a model perspective. Almost like they'll create some sort of like partnership with this advertising company that controls the ad platform. But then you'll see, you know, Instagram for what it is, break apart from Facebook. Facebook will operate a lot more independently from a platform perspective. It'll likely create a lot of issues for marketers who have come to find a lot of convenience out of what Facebook's created by having these near seamless integrations. All that being said, though, yeah, I think the business as is can break apart pretty easily, just because the brands are all so strong on their own. Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram. That's kind of how I see it, but I do see sort of that, like, sort of this fourth entity breaking apart from it that runs the advertising specifically. And that's kind of what Google has as well, right? Google has its own ad tech that exists apart from the Chrome browser, that exists apart from Android, that exists apart from the G Suite. The hard thing is, though, you know, we can all agree as consumers, big tech offers so much convenience, right? I mean, it offers amazing tools and it offers amazing access to others. The fact that I can communicate with my in-laws in Maine from Texas through these platforms is just, it's so convenient, right? So for consumers to kind of see these things happen, it might leave a little bit of bruising. It might make things a little bit less convenient than what we're used to. But the reality is this will open up the market in such a way that allows for that next awesome thing to actually have enough room to wiggle to the top and to let the world know that they exist. As is, it's really hard for a small, awesome concept to do that. So we kind of have to make some room for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking about, for instance, how could anyone possibly compete with YouTube? If you just think of how much data is hosted on their platform, the number of videos uploaded to what they have. I mean, it would just be mind-boggling to even think of a concept as to how you could start a company that could compete with YouTube, for instance, or even Facebook or Twitter for that matter. Yeah, I would almost say that would be impossible to legitimately compete with any of those major companies right now just because of the number of resources.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, the algorithms alone, I mean, the data science that goes into these things, it's not enough just to make something that looks beautiful and has a really, like, nice kind of end result for the user, but the engineering that goes into these things and the constant support and the constant optimization, you know, for a little startup, I mean, you're never going to compete with that. You're just not. And that's why we've seen, you know, that's why we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen the world of, quote, second tier search engines just disappear. Google has really pushed out every other search option. And yeah, Bing and Yahoo are still holding on. You know, you got Microsoft Search hanging on to like 10% of the search market. But Google's got 90% of all online searches. And it's because they offer such a simple experience. And the fact that you can type in, you know, 4 words out of your 12-letter word, and Google already knows what you're going to actually search for before you even enter that word, it's incredible, right? Like, how do you compete with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good luck.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, that's Adam Razzieri, Chief Marketing Officer at Agency Partner Interactive. Their website is agencypartner.com. Adam, I am unfortunately out of time, but this was definitely a great conversation that we will have to have another time during the new year once we figure out a little bit more what's happening with Section 230 and also this FTC suit against Facebook. So certainly lots to follow along as we head into 2021. Adam, really appreciate you going along with me today on a great conversation.
Brett, it's been a privilege. Thank you.
All right, got it recorded. So I'll be playing that back on Friday. And